Hello, fellow homebrewers. JP here, and I want to introduce to you the brand new Brewbuilt X1 Conical Series available at More Beer. More Beer sells the highest standard in homebrewing equipment, and the Brewbuilt Conicals are just that. They're made from mirror-polished 304 stainless steel, and they come with loads of features that you and I have been looking for. They have a full 2-inch bottom dump valve, which will eliminate your clogging issues, while the sturdy base includes 4 reinforced legs, just like those big pro tanks do. More Beer also carries the Brewbuilt line of options and add-ons like casters, pressure kits, and even external glycol chillers. So you can find out more about the new Brewbuilt X1 conical uni tanks by going over to morebeer.com for detailed videos on the entire line of Brewbuilt conicals. You can trust Brewbuilt with your next fermentation, and you can trust More Beer to find the right conical for you. Brewbuilt at morebeer.com.
Folks, welcome to the session. Thanks for joining us here on our wonderful, enjoyable podcast. I'm your host, Justin Crosley, back in the studio again this week with another live guest. We've been able to do it all year so far. I haven't had to have a remote guest since we got out of Zoom land in 2020-2021. And today, my guest is Seven Stills Brewery and Distillery. Brewing and distillery? Damn it.
Brewing and distilling, whatever you want to call it.
But it is brewing and distilling.
Brewery and distillery.
Oh, so I was close.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I practiced.
You almost had it.
I practiced.
Need your cards.
Yeah.
Oh, and I forgot to ask you just for, even though I've had you on the show before, too.
Yeah.
Is Aubert the French Aubert, or is it Obert?
It's actually Obert.
It is Obert.
Yeah.
Okay. You're
so
not French.
I'm not French.
Okay.
No.
Yeah. Should have checked that before the show, too.
No, I'm
whatever.
Not.
I'm still rusty after all these
beers.
Yeah. It's a lot of cobwebs to clear away, right?
Yeah. That's a good parody song.
It's not
still
bad,
rusty
yeah.
after all these.
That's
the
a Weird Al song for you right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
He must have done that already.
It must be, right?
It must be done.
Yeah. So Seven Stills out of San Francisco and in my studio here in sunny Concord today. And then Teresa Pasuti is in the studio co-hosting with me.
Yeah.
Thanks, Teresa.
Oh, my pleasure, always.
You both got stuck in all of the San Francisco Bay Area traffic today getting here. I appreciate you taking the trek.
No, it just gives me time to listen to my songs, you know, and blast the radio, have a little alone time. It's good.
Nice. Well, and for you... You're used to the extreme heat on this side of the bridge, but poor Tim here had to come. You know, it's probably a 30-degree change from San Francisco.
Well, I'm staying in Nevada right now, so it's baking hot up there.
Oh, so you do it every day.
Yeah, right. It's bad.
So I would stay at work longer if I'm you.
Yeah, definitely.
Know? Yeah, the San Francisco Bay microclimates never get old talking about that if you're a Bay Area resident.
Well, and we are so well adjusted to heat right now. We just start sweating. Like the moment you get too hot, you're just totally drenched in sweat all the time.
Yeah.
It's super fun.
Yeah, it's like humidity. It's just like coming out of your body. It's so weird.
What is it, like 105 in Nevada?
Yeah.
Around this week?
No. I mean, it hasn't been quite that high. It's been like high 80s, like low 90s. But we went to the pool yesterday and it was great.
Yeah,
so
that's all you need.
Yeah.
Yeah, and up in Auburn, just to give our listeners idea of what kind of heat we're talking about.
I mean, so we had probably 100 today, but we've honestly, it's been a mild summer because it's only been like 105.
Okay, yeah.
And it was 100 for like a week, but usually it's like for a month.
Right.
So like, honestly, you can't really complain that much.
No, that's not bad. Although, so I've always said, my listeners know, and I'm from the desert. I grew up in the desert. So I've been a lizard, you know, my whole life. But I've been in the Bay Area now for a long time, since 95. And this is the first summer where I can feel a change in my body. Because here it's been like 95, hasn't even really broken 100.
Mm-hmm.
And 105, 110, I was fine. I'm fine. And I've been that way for years, even here.
Really?
And this summer, which is like a kind of milder, it's only in the high 90s, I've been dying. And wow. I sat down and thought about it the other day, and I was like, shit, I'm evolving to the Bay Area climate after all these years. I don't consider that a good thing.
Well, I evolved to California climate like almost immediately. I moved from Colorado.
Oh, yeah.
And went to Southern California. And then when I went back to Colorado, I was like, oh, my God, it's cold.
Yeah.
Like the cold. I can't support the cold. I could deal with heat, never but could. Not the cold.
So now I'm stuck because I could never deal with the cold, and I still can't. And now I'm not even dealing with the heat. I'm going to have to move to San Francisco.
You're going soft.
I left.
Or Oakland.
I don't live in San Francisco anymore.
Yeah, because now you're Novato, you said. Not even there.
Nope.
Where's your home now?
I live in San Diego.
Oh, you're brilliant. That's what you do. when your body evolves, you go to San Diego.
That's where I grew up. So yeah, I moved back there.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a good move.
Yep. It's not too bad.
Yeah. All right, I got a couple things to get through on the business side. I want to thank our sponsor, More Beer, of course. I've been our sponsor since the beginning, and boy, do I love those folks. Go to morebeer.com and check it out. You've heard me talking about their Comos line of everything. I just love it. Get yourself a kegerator. I've got their plate chiller jockey box, which I'm going to be using this weekend. I'm very excited about it, except I'm going to interrupt business for a moment. It's going to sound random, and it is. Co-ed baby showers. I'm not into it. And I would never do it to my friends.
No?
And I guess this is, maybe this is sexist. I don't know. Or maybe I'm just really not into babies, right? I don't have kids. It's not like really in the plan. And, you know, somewhere along my lifetime and your lifetime, co-ed baby showers became the thing. And now I can't say no to them. I can't just say, oh, I don't like your baby. I have to go to a co-ed baby shower. But I'm bringing my Comos jockey box.
That's make it about the drinking.
That's and what less I'm about do.
100% that it's going to make it better. Yeah. Like, honestly, I think there can be two cohorts at this co-ed baby shower, and it doesn't have to be just the men and the women, because even though I have kids, I don't particularly enjoy babies either.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They're so useless.
You can, like, have the people out by the beer and the people who really want to, like, open the presents and do the games and, like,
and I'm hoping that's
you
what
can't
happens.
Force that stuff on people.
And I do love kids. Like, I've got my nephew's not a kid anymore, but I have, like, good friends where their little kids are my nieces and nephews, too. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like those babies when they were babies either. I don't like them until once they can talk to me, and, like, even like at 3 or whatever. Like, I don't know what age. What age do people start talking?
Oh, you know, sometimes one? It's earlier.
Is it really?
Yeah, it can be as early as one.
Let me change that. Converse. What age do they converse?
So I have a 2-year-old now.
Yeah.
And she is chatty.
Okay.
She's super chatty.
Yeah. So that's when I'm all in.
Is she a good listener?
She,
like, does she listen to your
she
feelings?
She does, yeah. And she repeats stuff, and she repeats stuff so much. She always says, did you hear my message? I'm like, oh my God, it's so cute.
See, that's when I'm all in. As soon as there's, like, some back and forth communication
before that it's a lump,
and everyone's like, no, you gotta come hang out with the baby, hold the baby, and I'm sorry, I'm just not that person.
It's a baby shower, but the baby's already born.
No, I'm just saying
confused.
In general, I'm now going back and just saying, like, I'm bouncing around a little bit.
I'm
just saying babies, they're just so, like, I don't know. Babies should just grow up with their parents alone until they can converse. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I'm kind of kidding that I don't like babies at all, but, like, the 3-year-old explanation, like, I'm there for that all day long.
Yeah.
I'm just like, tell me about all your things.
Yeah. Yeah. No, same. That's where I'm fully engaged. And then I'm like, I really do like watching little humans
until they get a little older.
Sponge. Like that. It fascinates me how fast they learn things.
It's exponential.
And that's what, so that I really love. I'm like, just skip over to that part and it looks super fun.
But that's why it's so cool when they're young and I'm a first time dad. So, like, I'm just obsessed with it because I'm like, this is exponential learning at this point. So I want to teach you as much as possible.
Yeah.
I just way overdo it, and I buy, like, the, like, neuroscience books and biology and, like, physics for babies, and she doesn't care at all.
Right, but
she's like, that's a red ball, and I'm like, yeah, it is a red ball, cool.
But see, even that, I'm like, yes, you see how they know it's a red ball? It's just fascinating.
I'm trying to teach her about, like, energy exchanges and stuff. And like, you see the ball is red, and I'm like, God, all right, well, we're missing the point here.
That's funny. But on occasion, she's gonna, like, spit something back to you, and it's gonna blow your mind.
She does it every day.
Ah, see, I love that.
That part's she's cool. in school, so she'll learn stuff every day, and she comes back and she just starts saying stuff, and it's super weird.
See, that part's cool. Yeah. And so that I do now. So I get I think I get the best of both worlds because I'm just fun uncle. I just show up, do all that hanging out, and then. Peace
bring
out.
The keg and leave.
Exactly.
So I'm bringing my More Beer Comos kegerator, and I'm also bringing, shout out, why not, because I love them and they're friends too. I'm bringing Faction Penske File Pale Ale.
Good beer.
As a
solid
keg.
Choice.
Yeah, yeah. They asked for a pale ale, and that's kind of always my go-to right now, the Penske. So I'm doing that. So thank you so much to More Beer and to all of our sponsors for bringing you this session. If you want to support the show, too, you can visit our sponsors like More Beer. There's a sponsor page on the website, thebrewingnetwork.com. You can click on any of those sponsors and check them out, too. You can donate via PayPal. You can subscribe, for as little as like $2 a month or just do like a one-time thing. It's a very low-budget show, and it's our listeners and our few sponsors that keep it alive. So we thank you for doing that. You can also, if you don't want to spend an extra dollar at all, you could do your Amazon shopping, which you're going to do anyway. Don't lie to me. You all shop on Amazon. Just click the Amazon banner right there on our homepage and then shop away. Just do your thing. All right. If you got any feedback for the show or our guests, I forward it along to them. You can send it to feedback@thebrewingnetwork.com.
So you just get a kickback from Amazon.
I'm not supposed to say that, but basically, yeah. Oh. I don't know. There's like weird things in their bylaws, but yeah, it's just like but it's like any affiliate program. I don't know why we can't say it. All the other YouTubers say it.
They must, yeah.
But yeah, like if you put links in your description of the show, which I don't do enough,
And then it's got like some attachment like on the end of the hyperlink.
Yeah, and then
something.
You just get like a little percentage. And so there's been months like Christmas is cool for us, like because some of our listeners who are really supportive, they'll like think about it. If they're gonna go make like some big purchases,
totally,
they'll just be like, oh, I'll remember to click the Brewing Network link.
And it doesn't cost them anything, right?
Not a thing. They pay the same price.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And it's it's always been a really cool thing for us. And I always just mention it because, not every listener wants to or can afford, like, an extra little Brewing Network donation. And
yeah.
Whatever. That's fine. That's why the show's free. But there are simple ways that cost you nothing. So, yeah.
It's passive income. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. My hope is that it grows, that I could just retire, like, next week. But I don't think that's going to happen. I met another early retiree. I'm fascinated also by early retirees.
It's the thing now.
Right?
It's what everybody in the Bay Area does.
Which is, the whole economy is going to come to a halt soon. Not because of what we think. It's going to be because everybody just decided
they're
not to
working.
Work.
They're I made $400,000 a year for the last 5 years, so I'm done.
Yeah.
And then I sold my $3 million house, and now I live in a tiny home.
And now I live in a van,
Yeah, literally, that's...
See, I'm already halfway there. I live in a van. I live in an RV. It's a big van. So I've downsized. I'm on my way. It's the income part is the second part of the equation.
You just need that passive income connection.
It'll get there eventually. Okay. So before we get to the story of Seven Stills, let's talk about the Kolsch from you that's in our glass. A delicious German-style Kolsch. I'm going to assume, before you tell me about the beer, that this is a beer you also use as a wash to make your spirits? It's not. Is it too low of an alcohol to start?
Yeah. Usually when we're making our whiskeys, we want to use something that's higher alcohol, because obviously the higher alcohol, the more alcohol you're going to get out of the beer.
Okay.
So this is just a beer that we make because we like it.
Got it.
Yeah.
It's a great style.
Yeah. It's super good.
And this is a nice beer.
Yeah. So it uses some of Admiral Malting's malt from the East Bay, from Alameda. So yeah, it's got some of their oats, and then the... It's basically super clean, just Pilsner malt.
Mm-hmm. It's got that little, like that slight kind of fruity, little perfume in the flavor, I think.
Yeah, it's like the Kolsch yeast. Do you know what yeast?
Yeah, I'm gonna pull up my cheat sheet here. I'm pulling a Drake.
I warned you. I was gonna grill you
pull
over
up your
this.
Phone to lyrics.
Yeah. You're freaking freestyling on the screen. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I don't.
Well, Drake was on some like some podcast thing and he's like freestyling, but they're filming it and he's got his phone in front of him. He's reading off the lyrics.
There's nothing free about it. Maybe style, but nothing free.
So this is their Pilsner malt, premium Pilsner.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And then it's basically just the Admiral YOLO Gold malted wheat and then the YOLO or the Admiral Pacific Victor.
Okay.
Oh, got it.
But you're asking about the yeast.
Yeah. Is it just a standard Kolsch yeast?
Yeah. It's just a Kolsch yeast, but I don't have what actual strain it is. But yes, it is. And Herzbrecher is the hops.
Oh, nice.
It's super light, super creamy. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be crushable, which I think it is.
Oh, it is. For sure.
Yeah.
It's a little maltier than mine, and that's probably that Pacific Victor.
Yeah.
So our Kolsch is super near and dear to us. We use German Weihrauch pills and just a little wheat.
Oh, nice.
So it's a little less malty, but it's not a flaw. It's a feature. Like, it's always like, you know, when you make your own beer, you always compare that beer style to the one you do. And you're like, oh,
and this seems like it's something that's easy to compare because it's such a neutral base. So anything really stands out in it.
Yeah.
But this actually this stemmed from a collaboration that we did with Admiral Maltings like 8 months ago. I guess it was called Maltster and Commander.
OK.
And Dave McLean from Admiral Maltings basically wrote the recipe for this beer.
OK. Oh,
cool. And we kind of adapted that because it was such a good beer into something that we ended up turning into one of our core styles.
Heck yeah.
So it was just so good. And it was like everybody who tried it was like, this is the best Kolsch I've ever had. And we're like, all right.
Yeah.
We're making this year round now.
So. Well, and so to me, Dave McLean is like one of the kings of classic styles. Like he just always was, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you wanted a good mild, you went to Dave, right? You went to Magnolia.
Yeah.
So that's a good, it's got a good pedigree, this Kolsch.
He does, yeah.
Yeah. Nice. All right. Beautiful beer. Okay. So let's do, now we've, if you can go, listeners, if you want to go back, we've had Tim on before. In fact, you've been on this show, but you also were on our distilling show, Heads and Tails, with that you were on with JP and Beardy, unless it was maybe your distiller that was on with them.
That might have been, my partner.
Gotcha. So you can go back if you want to listen to the original story, but so much has changed since then. I just want to give you like a quick version of the original history, but you started as a home brewer.
I did. Yeah.
Just brewing beer, but it sounds to me like you got excited about distilling.
I did, and it was because I was looking for a way to get into the craft beer industry.
Okay.
But I didn't like how busy it was and how saturated it seemed like it had become already.
I see.
So basically, I was trying to find a way to get into the craft beer industry without getting into the craft beer industry.
Yeah.
So I was already getting really into like this home brewing, like you're saying, and like I had a little 15-gallon setup at my house, and I'm making beers for myself, and I'm drinking them with buddies or whatever.
Yeah. What was your career then? What were you doing for your life?
I had just graduated from college, so I was running my mom's transcription company, so I had like a little bit of background in project management and managing employees, but this was kind of just a hobby, and I was still just, I was 21, 22, so I was still a little shithead, and I was just drinking a lot of beer at the time, getting into the culture and the quote-unquote culture.
Right, yeah.
I was in San Diego at that point, so I was just obsessed with Stone, obsessed with this whole idea, I think, of making a product that was your own that you could share with somebody that they really liked.
Okay.
And alcohol just kind of has this thing to it where everybody really likes it and they get excited about it.
Yeah, that's true.
So there was something about being able to share this product with other people that was really just like captivating to me.
Yeah.
So I knew I wanted to get into the space. I really liked how fun it was and how, you know, everybody who was doing these craft beers had really loud and really like outrageous packaging, and it was all cartoony, and they had these new styles of beer coming out once a week or whatever.
Yeah.
But I didn't like how busy the space was.
Okay.
So basically what I did was I entered into the category by going backwards, and I decided to start the company by distilling different styles of craft beer into whiskeys.
Okay.
And the idea was that we were going to try and like capture the audience that was already super like captivated by the craft beer scene, but introduce them into a new product that was craft whiskeys inspired by craft beers.
Okay.
Yeah.
So were those early craft beers also sold to drink on their own, or was it just
they
like...
They were not.
Yeah. So you were just... But making whiskey from true craft beer.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was experimenting a lot. So the first style that we did was... It wasn't one of the more like popular like hazy IPAs or a sour or whatever, but it was more traditional. So it was a chocolate oatmeal stout with peat smoked malted barley.
Okay.
And that was called Choke a Smoke.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was the first whiskey that we did, and it was just super different. But it was more traditional and like a little bit closer to like a normal style whiskey that you would try.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there? I don't know a lot about spirits. I'm not a spirits guy. Whiskey doesn't have to be aged 10 years? Like you didn't have to start 10 years before you sold your first whiskey?
It can be.
Okay.
So that was one of the biggest components of why I wanted to start the company, was because I felt like that was just the common thought, was that whiskey was, it was basically better based off of how long it's been aged for.
Yeah.
Whereas I wanted to showcase how the base ingredients that went into the spirit could showcase into different flavors and different styles of whiskey.
Got it.
Which I feel like was just completely overlooked.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the rule of thumb that we would always use is like a gallon of a barrel equates to a month of age.
Okay.
So we started using smaller barrels. So we were using a 5-gallon barrel to begin with.
Oh, wow.
And we're aging it for like 4 months.
So really small volume, small batch at that point.
Super small volume, super small batch. So the first batch we did, we hired Mill Valley Beer Works, which is now Four Point.
Okay.
But they closed Mill Valley Beer Works. But we hired them to brew us basically 300 gallons of a chocolate oatmeal stout with this peat smoke malted barley. They didn't have room in their fermenters, so they had us just provide our own tanks.
Yeah.
So I went on Craigslist and I bought some olive drums and I aged it, or I fermented it in those olive drums.
Yeah.
After it was done fermenting, I took that to Stillwater Spirits up in Petaluma, distilled it, brought that back to the city. It basically netted 30 gallons of whiskey, which is six 5-gallon barrels.
Okay.
So I aged those 6 5-gallon barrels for like 4 to 6 months. When it was done, packaged it myself, went out there, sold it, made a profit, and then came back and made double the size batch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the next one was like 12 barrels.
And just kind of kept
like
going.
18, yeah.
Okay.
And then eventually got to the point where we started using your neighbor's EJ Fair.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we were using
in their
them
Pittsburgh
in
facility?
In their Pittsburgh facility, yeah. So we were increasing it to like 15 barrels and then 30 barrels and 60 barrels. And eventually I think we got to the point where they couldn't keep up with us. So they had to stop.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's kind of skipping ahead a bit, right? Because you sort of went from, am I allowed to say that you kind of learned to distill at home? Like, is that?
Yeah, okay. It is a federal offense. But you can feel
it's not like they're catching you doing it at this point. I'm just saying the words.
With it. Yeah.
And then, you know, because I'm sort of reading through your story and you open up in some tiny tiny garage or something in San Francisco.
It was
actual storage.
It was like
unit.
A 400 square foot storage unit.
Like you that you pay like that like my storage unit with a bunch of antiques in it.
Storage Pro SF.
Oh wow.
It was like.
But you licensed the facility?
Yeah.
Really?
And you had your fermenters in there?
No. We had a type 7, so we were rectifiers. So we were contract brewing, and then we were contract distilling.
Got it.
And then we were renting a U-Haul truck and taking the unaged spirits back to the city where we're filling the barrels on our own.
Yeah.
We're aging it in San Francisco, and then we're bottling it there. And then since we were a type 7 rectifiers license, we can go out and do self-distribution too. So then we're also our own salespeople.
Right.
So we're going out there door-to-door slinging whiskey.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was what, like 2013?
Yeah, that was 2013 until 2016.
Okay.
Yeah. And then 2016 was kind of the turning point for us. So that was when I had our first banker come in.
Okay.
And he looked at the space and he was like, oh, this is super cool. Like, what do you need to take this to the next level?
I see.
And I was like, I need $100,000 to buy a still. And he was like, let me see what I can do. And like a couple days later, he came back. He got me a loan for $100,000. And
was it really that random? Like, this wasn't some friend or something. It was just kind of a random banker that took interest?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I reached out to him and I must have met him at a trade show or something like that.
Okay.
And I was just like, oh, yeah, we could use financing. But I didn't know anything about, like, how to do this or how to take out a loan or how to, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still don't know. Yeah.
It's... You're learning constantly. It's weird. Yeah.
So he comes up with money for a still, but you don't even have a place to put the still.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So you were surprised.
But that's where this whole thing starts kind of snowballing, because then you have to start figuring out the next steps.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's at least the starting point. So we got the $100,000 for the still, and then I'm like, oh... I also need a brew house so I can make like the beer that we're going to use to distill. And then I also need fermenters. Oh, I also need a space. Right. Now I got to pay for construction.
Yeah.
So that's when I figured out how to do equity crowdfunding, basically.
Okay.
So that one was kind of friends of friends. And I would go out and I would sell like a membership unit in the LLC that I had established.
Okay.
And then they would give write me a check for $25,000 or whatever, and I would use that for the construction.
So it's like, so it's shares, just like being a shareholder,
like, but shares,
more, but
yeah,
a little more private.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you mind me asking, like, what do they get in return? What's the incentive for them?
Like a share.
Just a share in the company.
Yep.
So if the company grows, like, they'll get returns on that, whatever their shares are. So it's not like a
gift. Ideally, yeah.
In other words, it's not like taking a little loan from your friends and family that might want, you know, 7% back.
It's like you're buying a, it's like you're buying a share in Apple. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, I've done two public crowdfunding raises so far. And we get the question a lot, like, oh, what do I get for this? And I'm like,
sure.
What do you get when you buy a stock of Apple? Like,
yeah.
You think that they're sending you a little iPod or something? Like, you know,
yeah,
like
yeah,
you're
yeah.
buying an equity stake in their company, and if they perform well,
yeah.
then you're going to get a return on your money.
Okay.
It's just, it's a little different for this kind of thing because it's a private
yeah.
investment, so you're not able to, like, liquidate your shares.
You can't just sell off.
Yeah.
Okay. So they have to wait until there's some other event.
Exactly. Like, if there's an IPO or something, so if we were listed on some kind of a public
yeah.
platform, then you could sell your shares. Like, there would just have to be a public method for somebody to be able to sell their equity, and that would require, like, a public market for somebody to want to buy that equity.
So even those first investors, and of course, as we go through this interview, we're going to find out how much you've grown. So it's
yeah.
really, really phenomenal. They're still just hanging on for a future a payout when something like an IPO happens.
Exactly.
Or another yeah. way, because there's probably other way if the company gets bought.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the big hope for everybody. Is it's
sure.
like you see the news about Ballast Point getting acquired for $1 billion.
Yeah.
And
you're
like,
yeah.
oh, I'll throw in some money. Like,
yeah, hope for that.
Yeah. yeah. Hope for that.
yeah. Man.
Exactly.
Wait, I can get my checkbook out. okay, so you do that sort of funding for your first brewery.
For the first brewery,
right?
Yeah,
and you
that
end
was the
up
Bayview facility.
Bayview,
yeah.
and you end up with like a 7,000 square foot something or other.
It was
brewery.
Like 4,400.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so it was a 4,400 square foot facility.
And what size brew house?
That was a 15-barrel brew house. We started out with two 15-barrel fermenters. And then basically, I don't know if you want to go into this now, but we added on beer in like 2018.
Okay.
So once we added on beer, basically all of our sales and the demand for the beer started growing faster than the sales and the demand for the spirits.
Okay.
So that also led to the requirement of us to have more space.
Yeah.
So basically in 2018, we added on 9 30-barrel fermenters. So we went
wow.
from 2 15s to 9 30s and the 2 15s, like
okay.
And did you had a tap room at that point?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you open that facility with a tap room?
We did, but it was more of like a craft liquor like spot. So it was So that was a Type 74. So our timing was perfect because the craft distiller's license came into effect in 2016, like mm-hmm. right when we opened the Bayview facility. But the interesting thing about the Type 74, which is the craft distiller's license, is that you can serve tastings, but you're limited on the amount of tastings you can serve.
Yeah.
So because it's liquor, they basically say you can serve up to 1.5 ounces of liquor per person per day.
Oh, yeah.
So we have all these people coming out to the Bayview, and they're able to have like 6 quarter-ounce tasters, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But then the ABC or the government or whoever is saying you can serve them a keg of beer if they want to drink it there. They could sit there and they can have 100 pints, but they can only have 1.5 ounces of liquor.
Right. Mm.
So like, I started looking at all these customers who were coming in on the weekend. It was getting super busy. And I'm like, why don't we sell them more stuff?
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
like, why don't we start brewing beer at the same time? So you can come out here. You can do a whiskey tasting flight. You want to stick around because you just took a $30 Uber down here. Like, have two beers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which it continues to evolve things. So you're like, oh, you're going to have a food truck. Now we're going to have some small snacks inside.
Right.
Now we're going to start packaging our beers, selling 4-packs to go, selling 6-packs to go. And then all of a sudden we're a brewery,
yeah.
which was kind of the intention to begin with. So
yeah.
it did work.
Yeah.
So
that totally worked. Yeah.
It's super interesting, but it did work.
I love it.
Yeah.
All right. Why don't we take a quick break? We got a lot more to talk about. We've got some more to taste too. So you're listening to The Session with Seven Stills, and we'll be right back after this quick break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back to the program. Thank you again for hanging out with us today. Whatever you're doing, driving, drive safe if you are, sitting, I don't know, working or should be working, quiet quitting somewhere. That's a thing, I think. I read
about. Being prematurely retired.
Thank you for listening to our show. We're still here with Seven Stills and learning about their fascinating story. I think I have a lot to learn from Tim. He seems to be making money, so that's a good thing. That's what I have to learn from Tim. Or maybe just spending it all back on the company, which, you know, that I can do well. Yeah. We got a Pilsner in our glass first, though. Seven Stills Pilsner. And as Tim just told us, like, the beer kind of ended up secondary after the you know, first distilling. Mm-hmm. And then started, you know, making a bunch of beer and selling beer in the tasting room. I did want to just point out or just give you kudos or something, that from this storage unit and self-distributing and it going out there and like pounding the streets, you gained enough sales and reputation that you're like, oh, cool, now we need a 15-barrel brewery. That seems like a massive step to me to go from the storage unit to a 15-barrel brewery.
Thank you.
But you guys were just what? You're just out on the pavement every day just pushing your spirits?
We would drive to a neighborhood in San Francisco and we would park the car and take a bottle of vodka and we would walk down the street and we would see a liquor store and we'd walk inside and say, hey, do you want to try our vodka?
Yeah.
And they'd say, oh, awesome. It's local. Give us two bottles. And then we'd walk back to the car, bring them two bottles with an invoice.
Wow.
Continue walking down the street, go to a restaurant. Oh, cool. You want some vodka? Yeah, we'll take two cases, go back to the car, and keep on doing it. And we would just do that until we hit every place in San Francisco.
Amazing.
And it got to the point where we eventually had, I think, like 200 buying accounts, and there was two of us.
Okay.
And then we started getting on the radar of distributors. So that's when, like, Southern approached us, and they're like, oh, cool, we would love to carry your brand, like, because we're seeing you all over the city, and everybody's saying, like, have you heard about these new guys who are making, like, vodka and whiskey?
Yeah.
So it was really cool because we got to basically go out there and pick the distributor that we wanted to work with, which...
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What a great success story. But because of hard work, just like, we're just going to pound the pavement.
Literally pounding the pavement.
Yeah. Did you ever think about one of those trench coats with, like, bottle...
Right, yeah.
...holes?
It was already super illegal to be selling it from our car, but that would have been...
Right.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
Little flasks, and I Hey. Well, then you a shooter.
I got whiskey on this side,
yeah. And then vodka over here. The other. Well, and it proved your kind of theory, or at least what you wanted, because you thought, hey, just craft beer was just too busy, too saturated. So, you know, at the time that you started, you could have walked around to every place with your craft beer, but people would have been like, yeah, there's a bunch of other San Francisco craft brewers. Maybe I'll try yours.
Totally, yeah.
But you were like, they were excited because you were unique in the marketplace.
Yeah.
So what a great premise to start with. You proved yourself right.
Yeah.
You know, and then got to go do beer later.
Exactly.
So yeah. I love that. Cool. Well, tell us about the Pilsner.
The Pilsner was inspired by a beer that I think we all tried at GABF one year. And then we all came back and decided to do the exact same thing.
But, oh, yeah.
I don't know if you guys have tried that, like, slow pour Pilsner. I think it's called
We have.
But every single person went to GABF and they tried this beer and they're like, this is so freaking good. Like, I'm bringing this back. So originally this beer was called Slow Flow.
Okay.
And it was like a Czech style Pilsner that was meant to be poured and enjoyed slow.
Right.
So it was like super cool. And we got all these like Czech side pour handles. I don't know if you guys.
Yeah. The liquor faucets.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. So it was like, oh, you can aerate it and you can have like just the milk or you can have whatever. And just basically allowing people to drink this beer in a different way. But the whole point was it's super creamy, super refreshing, easy drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is delicious. Yeah. And another one that's crushable just right out
super
of the can.
Crushable, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Bierstadt, right?
Yeah, is that Bierstadt.
I don't mind saying
that. I think it's Bierstadt.
Yeah. We go every time Teresa and I are in Denver, we meet up at Bierstadt.
Yeah, last time I was in Denver, I literally was there every single day.
it's just so good.
Like, yeah. It's so like beer Disneyland this. For me. Like, yeah. I just get all like willowy whenever Ashley
like,
comes around. I love it.
Yeah, I'm
so
going
much.
To Denver on Friday, so that's great.
Oh, you got it. Yeah, just
and by the way, you're not the only. All the brewers know it. If you if you mention Denver and lagers to another brewer, they're all like, Bierstadt.
Yeah.
Bierstadt.
Everybody
We all faint with
yeah,
like
envy.
It's the mothership.
Yeah.
That's all
so good. It's just water. Yeah. It's just like you're drinking delicious water.
And all of their beers, by the way. But yes, their Slow Pour Pils is number one, but all of their beers are really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This stands up. This is a great Pilsner.
Thank you.
Yeah, really well done.
Yeah, it's super easy. And I don't know if we want to talk about like the change in strategy at all in terms of beers or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we could.
I love strategy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I basically... I think that the previous model of like craft beer, like double IPAs, kettle sours, and imperial stouts has kind of died.
Okay.
It died? I'm so excited.
Right. Yeah, no, we thought it was still on the way down, but okay. Yeah.
I think it's dead.
Okay.
You think it's dying? Well, so I mean, you've been ahead of the game on some things. So
what do you think?
So I hope you're right.
What's replacing it?
Well, I think RTD is replacing it actively, ready to drink, but that wasn't necessarily the point of like this analogy, but I think that more approachable styles of beer that are simpler are going to start replacing craft beer. I think that something really interesting happened during COVID, and I think that was because all of these hype breweries like the Humble Seas and like the Great Notions and the Russian Rivers, who used to be super hard to get, closed their tap rooms because COVID hit. And because they had all this excess beer, they started canning more of it.
Right.
And they started sending it to different markets. And then all of a sudden people started buying that beer instead of the local beers, which I think basically caused the local beers to start stacking up on the shelves, which basically led the section, like the craft beer section in like say any liquor store, to grow from like one times the size to two times the size to four times the size immediately. And I think that the only way that you can really stand out in that crowd is by doing something that's louder and more noisy. So I think it led to a lot more like outrageous names, like colorful packaging, like all these things that were already synonymous with beer, and like crazy styles of like cereal beers or whatever, and like just this weird stuff. And I think the chaos of all these people trying to stand out in addition to the industry and this category growing from 1x to 4x like in a matter of like 6 months led to this just like overwhelming effect on consumers. So when you're going to the liquor store and you're trying to pick out a 4-pack, you're looking at like all of this shit on the shelf, and you're like, I can't even think about this. Like, I don't want to like have to think about what one of these beers I'm going to pick for my like night off or whatever. I'm going to go buy a 6-pack of Kolsch.
Okay.
I'm going to buy a 6-pack of Pilsner. So all of a sudden, I think we saw, like, if you talk to liquor store or grocery store owners, we saw a shift to beers like Modelo. And all of a sudden you see this market share moving towards macro brands like Modelo, or even the people who are adapting like the Fort Points of the world, who are making a Kolsch like the KSA in a 6-pack, which evolves into a 12-pack. So I think a lot of the craft consumers started also drinking these macro styles of beer, which led to a decreased demand for these craft styles while you get a market that's more and more flooded.
Yeah.
And I think it's just caused chaos in the industry, and I don't think there's really any turning back from it.
I see. Other than to embrace it.
Which is what we're trying to do,
Okay.
So what I did was I switched all of our model over to making 6-packs in 12-ounce cans.
Really?
And all approachable styles of beer.
Okay.
So it's basically, I was trying to span the spectrum of styles based off of ABV. So I did a 4.2% apricot wheat beer first, and then the 4.7% Kolsch, 5.5% Pilsner, and then a 6.7% hazy IPA, which eventually turned into a West Coast IPA.
I see.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I'm still doing this like hype can model at the same time, but that was completely what dominated everything we were doing pre-COVID, because that's what everybody wanted, was like this crazy new IPA, like whatever, like super hazy, super juicy, like whatever, milkshake IPAs. So I'm still doing that, but it's just way less of the focus of the company.
Sure.
So it's like I feel like that's what people are buying like once a week now.
Yeah.
But what people are buying every day is like a light style that they don't have to think about because they want a beer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, and you're describing me as a consumer, but I've sort of always been that way.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm not the person you're talking about. So what I want to know from you, because I'm trying to think about exactly who you're speaking of with this shift. How many barrels a year do you think you're going to make this year?
We're still small. We're probably doing like 5,000.
Okay. Because I was thinking that this shift you're talking about, which I do see, but I see it on a more micro scale even, mm-hmm. that more small brewers like you are putting out pilsners, hoppy pilsners. Like we're getting more lagers than we ever got. Mm-hmm. And they're, by the way, they're more delicious than they ever were too. But in my scene, we're still selling a ton of hazy, a ton of IPA, and so is everybody else, right? So I'm wondering if like, but this shift you're talking about happened at the more mass scale and is still trickling down to the small brewer scale. Does that make sense? And you're planning that, for the future, I guess, is what I'm saying.
You're maybe a little biased because you have this spot. And like, if talking about a spot like this, like you're going to come here and you're going to want to try that.
That's
new
what people
crazy
are coming for.
Style
yeah.
of beer. Like, you're not going to come seek out like a pilsner here.
Yeah.
But like, how often are you doing that? Like once a week?
Yeah.
And then how often are you drinking beer? Like five times a week?
Right.
Well, and my question for you is like, how much are your beer is going in cans versus draft accounts?
A lot of cans.
Hmm. Is it more cans than draft?
Yeah.
Okay.
And like mostly six packs?
All six packs.
Yeah. All six packs. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so you said a few. You're still doing some like
we're still doing the four pack 16-ounce cans, but it's all on a pre-sale basis. So we're basically like allocating cases to accounts, and then if they want it, then we'll send them like one case.
I see.
But it's more just to drive people to the tap rooms that we have in the city.
Yeah.
To keep them excited about what's new, mm-hmm. and to kind of build out like the tap list also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you still kind of as a tap room you still have to do, but you're talking about on the shelf too. Is really your main Which for me on the shelf. Yeah, I'm buying Sierra Nevada Pale Ale almost every time. I'm just looking for something simple. Not that it's simple, but you see my point. I also don't want to think too much about it. If I want to think about it, I buy from myself.
Yeah.
I'll come here, and you're right. That does only happen for me about once a week, where I'm like, cool, let me grab a West Coast. Let me try this other thing. But the rest of the week, because I am still drinking, it is more simplified. But like I said, I've just sort of, I think I've always been that way. But I can see your point that that's maybe growing out that way as well.
I think something else happened at the same time. And I think that's that the majority of the craft beer drinkers and like the craft beer brewery owners are millennials.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that over the last couple of years, we've all gotten older.
And
I think part of us all getting older has got us to start thinking more about what we're eating and what we're drinking.
Yeah.
And I hear this all of the time that people don't want to have an IPA or a hazy IPA because it makes them feel full.
Yeah.
Or fat.
Yep.
So they're going for a White Claw.
Yeah.
Instead.
I hear brewers saying that.
Yeah.
I have a brewer that I respect so much. I won't say his name for his own sake because it's such this faux pas. But he's like, man, if I go out, I either need a light cocktail, maybe a cider, but it is not a big old IPA like I make.
No, yeah.
Because of that same reason. It's like, I just feel real. And, you know, and I related. I was like, yep, I feel that way.
Plus the hangovers are worse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's this evolution of the style, the styles that we make.
I think so, yeah.
IPA is still king if you look at the sales numbers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not king over hard seltzers and stuff like that, but in the beer, in the craft category.
Mm-hmm.
But is it declining?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, I totally agree with a lot of what you said, but I think having less styles and focusing your energy and efforts into a few styles to distribute is mm-hmm. really important.
Yeah.
So instead of distributing 15 things and always something new and different, like it really helps to have some core brands.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely our strategy, which is kind of.
But what's funny about that, Teresa, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No,
just to hear
interrupt.
You say core brands. Mm-hmm. I think it was just before the pandemic, the word on the street was that core brands are dead.
100%.
That the only people that are living off core brands are Sierra Nevada and New Belgium, and the rest of you better come up with the next new thing or you're dying. Wasn't that what was being said?
I know, and I don't believe them at all, because our entire experience as a brewery is mm-hmm. that we do half of our production on one beer.
Right.
Literally one beer.
Yeah.
Which beer is that?
It's called 1-2 Punch. It's a hazy IPA with peach and mango.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the core of our brewery ethos,
but it's your customer base.
It's our most popular beer by a long shot. And we literally right now, I can tell you it's in four of our tanks. We only have 10.
Dang.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, well, we, and I think we have been like, that is whatever success we've enjoyed. It's definitely been because of doing a core beer like that and really building it up.
Well, and here's where some of these theories, like, not fall apart, but they're hard to blanket. There is some locality to that. And, yeah, and I get to hear that from all the interviews I do with brewers. Like, oh, my top-selling beer is my corn-based lager. Yeah, that's my top. Right, that's one person's very hyper-local experience. Mm-hmm. And another your hyper-local experience is that hazy.
Yeah.
And another one is, oh my gosh, we sell more red ale than anything.
Yeah.
And when I hear these interviews, I'm like, this is insane. How can it be so broad? You can look at the whole of the industry, which is what you were doing. And yeah, I think you're right. But yeah, then when you say hazy, is like, and it's not going down, it's going up. That's also a hyper-local thing for you, you know. Not that hazy isn't popular everywhere, but
no,
you see my point.
But I think just focusing your efforts.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing. Like, your sales has a message, and this is the message, and this is what we do. Mm-hmm. And it also helps from a, like, sales standpoint, because hopefully you're actually going to have enough of that beer to satisfy the customer base. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if you try to do 20 things, you're always running out, then, like, you're always letting someone down.
So how many do you have now, Tim? Like, what is your core that you're focusing on?
There are four.
Four. Beers. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it's basically a rotating core is the first one. So that was just the apricot wheat, but we just replaced that with the hazy pale ale.
Okay. Can we try that one? Is that what we have next?
Yeah.
Can you pour that, Teresa? Thank you.
And then the lowest ABV of the actual core is the Kolsch, which is the 4.7%. And then the Czech style Pilsner is 5.5%. And then the West Coast IPA is 6.7%.
Got it. Okay. So the West Coast, and you're doing the West Coast IPA in six packs too. Like, that's part of that whole core.
Yep.
Yeah. See, I like that too. I don't buy, and this is, but I'm not your average craft beer drinker either. I don't generally buy IPA by the six pack anymore. I did a few years ago, but you can be sure I'm buying all my Pilsners, all my Kolsches, and all my pale ales by the six pack. Mm-hmm. You can be absolutely sure of that.
Yes, yeah, so something else that you just said, Teresa, rang true, but, like, we previously did, our core beer was the Hazy IPA, mm-hmm, and that was our top-selling beer by far. It was, like, 50 to 60% of our total gross sales and our total production, and I made the move of killing it and replacing it with our West Coast IPA.
Oh, wow.
And then I think it's working.
You don't know. Did this just happen?
So yeah,
you're good.
I did this. I killed our Hazy Double IPA and replaced it with a West Coast Single. It's not working all that
well. It's not working. Okay, yeah.
Give it time.
I know. Right. I love this beer, so I'm sticking with it.
I still love Hazy IPAs. It's like, that's like my go-to. That's my favorite beer. Like, okay, if I'm going to go to a bar like yours, I'm going to come and I'm going to drink a Hazy IPA.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, I think the consumer tastes are also shifting away from hazy IPAs, and I think they're shifting towards more approachable styles of beer.
Okay.
Like the West Coasts.
Yeah. Well, and you really do have to think about that consumer too, which clearly you're doing. I'm preaching the choir. But one of the most successful things about the hazy IPA was to provide people who didn't like bitterness with a beer that has all the other things that they like, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the classic styles, even a Pilsner, which I love, it's a bitter style, right? They're gonna, but maybe it's been a little palate training method with the hazies, mm-hmm, and now they'll transition to a little bit of bitterness. Because even these classic, you know, your Pilsner's got the right amount of bitterness, but it's bitterness.
Yeah, for sure.
This pale ale, real quick, or not real quick. Okay, the aroma, and I hope this is a compliment. So fruity pebbles.
Yeah, super tangerine.
Yeah. Gosh, do I love Fruity Pebbles.
So that used to be my nickname.
Candied orange.
Is that right? Should I call you that for the rest of the show?
Please don't. They're going to be like, this guy's from San Francisco, Fruity Pebbles.
Yeah. Yeah. So I haven't even tasted it yet, but it just smells perfect.
Yeah.
I'll use my cheat sheet again. Mm-hmm. Pilsner malt, aromatic malt, biscuit malt, hops, CTZ, Simcoe, Wakatoo, and then all Wakatoo dry hop. It's not, I said hazy before, it's not hazy, it's a dry hop pale ale.
Okay, got it. It's that Wakatoo, I think, really coming through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
I'll have to try that a little more.
So tropical, fruity.
Such a good, God. It's, and just barely bitter, like, really nice beer.
Yeah.
I think it allows for the production of diacetyl in the beer, which is something that I really like as an off flavor.
Okay.
So that's why, like, Almanac used to make a beer that was called like Wakatoo Sour, and it was my favorite beer that they'd make.
Okay.
And it was because it had this flavor that was super similar to like Pediococcus. Like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but it's got like this kind of like creamy, like it's almost like a diacetyl kind of
little slick on the tongue too.
Yeah, which is an acceptable like byproduct of that style of beer. So I really like that flavor, and I really like that in that specific, I think just because that hop allows for that flavor to be produced.
I see. What does that mean, that it allows for it to be produced? Like it's just that it's not an inhibitor of it? Like
it's just a byproduct of the fermentation. So I don't know. I don't know why.
Yeah. That's because I would think maybe it allows it to taste more acceptable rather than, but I'm no brewing scientist.
I don't get that flavor. Yeah. To me, that is a huge off flavor. It's a huge turnoff, and I don't get that.
But you're not, I'm not tasting either.
I'm only moderately sensitive. I have put myself up against my brewers, a couple of the brewers, and they are way better than me, and my taproom manager. So I can't say it's not there, but I can't detect it.
I think maybe I'm associating it more with the actual Wakatoo Sour from Almanac. And that's why I'm thinking that it's here, because I definitely don't taste it at all. But it has that kind of like creaminess to it, which maybe is just like a correlation in my brain of like, oh, I really like that flavor of Almanac beer.
This is a pale ale I would buy the six pack for sure.
It's super good. Yeah, so this is this is actually an interesting collaboration, but it's with an organization called Pangea Seed.
Okay.
So this is something that we were just talking about a little bit, but I'm super into like ocean conservation and just like generally the environment and giving back as much as we can. So Pangea Seed is an organization that is helping with ocean conservation, and they're doing a project with this group called Seawalls, and the Seawalls project is going to be taking place in Emeryville.
Okay.
So basically it's spreading awareness about ocean conservation through artivism.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's led by this guy, this incredible artist named Joey Rose, who designed the can for us. But they're basically doing these installs and these activations throughout Emeryville in September, and they're taking over like 8 big walls in Emeryville and doing like this big thing. But anyway, $1 from every six pack that we produce goes to their organization for this cause.
Nice.
Yeah.
See, I like that. Putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah. And then it's also, we can tie it into like this, this effort that I started back in 2018 called Beers for the Bay.
Okay.
Where I would go out there and I would just do like a cleanup. So basically I was operating in the Bayview, and it seemed like it was an area that was just super neglected by the city. And it wasn't, originally it wasn't like a thing that I was trying to market or anything. I just was super pissed off about the trash everywhere.
Yeah.
So all I did was I went to Facebook and I said, if anybody shows up and they help me pick up trash for 2 hours, I'll give you a free beer afterwards.
Oh yeah.
So I just went down, I rented a U-Haul by myself, and then I went down to the brewery at like 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever on a Sunday, and there were like 50 to 100 people waiting outside to clean the streets with me.
Wow.
And I was like, this is insane. So that's something that just kind of like continued spiraling into this effort that we eventually were doing like once a week, and cleaning up the bay or cleaning up the Mission Bay or doing like an ocean beach cleanup or something like that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. I like to see people actually doing it, because what is it? Greenwashing? You're not greenwashing. You're actually just going out there doing it yourself too.
Yeah. And I think it's more than just actually doing the work. I think that there's a positive externality associated with seeing people on the street cleaning the trash. And I think it was something that really resonated specifically with the Bayview community, because I feel like they also kind of had the sentiment that like their community was being overlooked. So when they would see a bunch of people going out there and cleaning the streets, they would be like, oh, that's awesome. Somebody actually cares about our neighborhood.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And be like, thanks for doing this. Like, and maybe it led to them throwing their trash away later or something. Instead of throwing it on the street.
And it's so much better. We're doing some cleanup efforts around here downtown, and I'll go talk to the business owners to get involved, come to some of our meetings. And, you know, the most common thing I hear is, nobody's going to do anything. It's not going to make any difference. And then I go to the meeting, and we're like, we're making so many differences here. We're making so many strides.
Every little thing, adds up. It's just...
Yeah.
I mean, that's why if you tie it to the ocean, I just feel like that's so powerful because if you think about removing a piece of trash from a street or whatever, like people don't really care. They're like, yeah, whatever, you're going to clean the streets. But it's like, if that piece of trash is going to go into the ocean and it's going to potentially kill a turtle or a fish, that's powerful. And you're like, I don't want that to happen. Like, this is me causing this effect on the environment. And
sure.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I agree. All right. We got a couple more beers to get through. I'm going to get us to another quick break. When we come back, we're going to learn about that. And then I want to talk, just even if it's briefly, you've had such this exponential growth, and we haven't even gotten fully to that. But I feel like a lot of it happened, and then the pandemic hit. And that happened with so many, but you were on this kind of trajectory. And I thought, if you don't mind, maybe just talking about that for a few minutes when we come back.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Hang in there. You're listening to The Session. We've got Tim Obert from Seven Stills in here with us, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for hanging out with us here on The Session. We've got Tim from Seven Stills in the studio. Teresa's with me. We're trying through some of their beers and learning about their very cool story. Got their West Coast IPA in front of you there, Teresa. And then we've got some of your, I don't know, soon to be not gone 16-ounce cans, or you'll always just have them there to kind of still bring in some excitement for the beer nerds.
For the beer nerds.
Yeah.
I call it the beer connoisseurs. I don't
the
like
beer
that word.
Yeah. So I've been doing it long enough, and I'm a self-proclaimed beer nerd that I'm allowed to. You don't have to do it, but
it just sounds bad. My sales director always calls it like the nerd bars, and I'm like, it's not nerdy. It's cool. I like it.
Yeah. I embraced it early on. I was like, I don't care. Yeah, nerds. We call me what you want. Yeah. But you're right. You're right. We try not to be, we certainly here at my bar try not to be snobby about it either. If I catch my team do anything like that, I'm like, whoa, that's not what we do.
Be cool.
We show everybody about beer, and if all they want is a Modelo, then offer them something close, and we don't shit on that.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. My team knows that, but I'm just saying, every now and then you get a little grumpy bartender and you're like, hey, come on. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't be a beer. The worst thing you could be is not a beer nerd. It's a beer snob.
That's the worst.
Elitist.
Yeah. Don't do that.
I am actually a beer snob. Yeah. I just like keep it on the inside.
Right.
I don't let it out so other people know. You know.
In some ways, you know, most brewers are beer snobs, but it doesn't mean that they don't drink, that they don't love a Modelo or some other kind of Mexican lager or even a Coors Light or whatever it might be. It doesn't mean that. It just means the standards are high for every single beer they drink. Isn't that what you mean about you being an inside beer elitist?
Well, yeah. I mean, like being a beer snob means that if you have a beer that you don't love, you're not going to drink that beer. Like you will struggle and pour that out.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
Like that is, you're just not going to drink that beer. But I've had so many Miller High Lifes in the presence of other brewers. Like, I would never drink that many of those beers myself, but we all get together.
If that's what's up.
We're at the bar late. Yeah.
Yeah. So in that, if you define it that way, I guess I'm a beer snob, except I will talk about how I don't like the beer, but I will generally finish it, and that just comes from my poor upbringing. Like, and not by poor, like my parents raised me poorly.
Like,
but
P-O-U-R.
It was just broke. Then I'm like, yeah, but I'm still good. I bought it, so I'm going to finish it.
I don't even think it's like a poor upbringing. It's more of just being like, I mean, for me, it's more like stingy. I'm just like, I don't want to waste this beer.
I'm not going to waste it.
Like, I don't like it at all, but I'm going to drink it.
It has to be... I mean, I've dumped some. I'm sure you have too. It has to be real bad.
It does have to be bad. Yeah.
It has to be like just awful to not drink it. Otherwise, it's like, well, I hope the next one's better, but I'll finish this. You know. So, all right. Well, tell us about the West Coast. What hops do you like to use in your core West Coast IPA?
Okay, so I just told you guys about the transition from the hazy.
Oh, right, to this one,
to this one. So this is the exact same beer.
That's that, okay.
But it's not hazy.
West Coast.
As a West Coast.
I have done this many times.
You have?
Yes.
I wanted to do some kind of a play off of like, because the original hazy IPA was called 5 Pounds, which was called 5 Pounds because we used 5 pounds of mosaic hops per barrel. And I wanted to do a play off of that and call this like West of the Five. Or something, because it's like also like West Coast is like very like SoCal, and like SoCal is all about like the five and whatever.
Yep.
But yeah, so this is 5 pounds of Mosaic hops per barrel in West Coast IPA form.
Hmm. Okay. And you just filter the shit out of it? Is that the difference? Or how do you get... Why is it...
Biofine, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the difference
it's
in the haze.
Like, yeah, use some biofine, and then it's not like super aggressively dry hopped.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got and it. Are you... But you're using a different yeast to make this beer, right?
It's USO01.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, like,
so
you
I guess,
can...
So yeah, it's just the yeast, basically.
It's really...
But that'll make a big difference, won't it? It doesn't taste like your hazy at all, does it? I haven't tasted it, so I'm just... Yeah, but
it
I'm guessing.
Make, I, well, in my experience, it does make a huge mm-hmm. difference.
Oh, I think so, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good beer. That is very Mosaic-focused on my palate. That's what I'm getting.
I like it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a nice one. All right, we've got some others that we... We're, this is our last segment, so we got a bit of time left to do. Okay, so before the break, I kind of said, hey, I just wanted to at least talk a little bit about, you know, COVID and your trajectory. So you opened a very large, very awesome facility in Mission Bay, yep. part of San Francisco, in 2018. Is that right? Or earlier than that, even?
No. We started working on it in 2018.
Okay.
And San Francisco is a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
So it took 2 years for us to get the restaurant and the tap room and the cocktail bar open.
Wow.
So I got that spot open in November of 2019.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it probably wasn't terrible in November.
November was
through February.
Our entire company's history.
Yeah.
December was our best month.
Oh, and you're like feeling like, good. You're like, oh, this gamble's paying off.
Well, oh, yeah. It's also... I mean, for me, it was really important to stay in San Francisco because our whole company is really rooted in San Francisco, and it's like the seven stills for the seven hills of San Francisco. Like,
yeah.
I want to have the brewery here. So we built it there. It was a gamble because, you know, it's really, really stupid expensive to operate in San Francisco, and everybody's like, why would you open a production facility in the middle of the most expensive city in the country at the time?
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, well, we're in Adobe's headquarters. So Adobe has the top three floors of our building. So we've got a built-in customer base of 2,500 employees upstairs.
Okay, yeah.
So
you did. Oh, man. Okay, so you go like gangbusters. It's a good thing to do. And by, yeah, real estate's expensive there. Labor's expensive. It's, you know, the whole thing. So good. They were obviously asking you valid questions. Okay, but then COVID hits and we all just sort of experienced that. Right?
Yeah, we can gloss over the ABC thing if you want. But
yeah,
that's fine.
Which is what that getting your license? You mean?
Yeah, well, getting our license suspended for 90 days, but then that led into COVID.
Oh, so do we not timing, want to talk about? I don't know what happened with that. I
mean,
I
was pretty public about it, but I lost my license for 90 days for Tide House violations.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that started in February of 2020.
Got it. Wow. So you had some cash reserves or something to make it through even that? That's rough. Or just by the skin of your teeth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So that was February, was supposed to end in May, but then COVID hit on March 16th.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. My listeners are going to be mad at me if I do. Sorry. The accidental Tide House or like this is a whole thing?
No, it was
thing.
An
like,
intentional Tide House.
Yeah, that's I'm assuming. Otherwise, you wouldn't even, you'd be like, nah, I'm a criminal. I don't want to talk about it. Like, that's not what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot. And basically, once the ABC decides to start poking around, they start poking around.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to find all the things.
Yeah, and they found a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. So they do 90 days, no production, no selling. Is that what it is? Like you just
so can't... they were super cool about it, and they let us keep the beer that we had produced in the tanks and our fermenters in the Bayview facility and continue packaging.
Okay.
But we couldn't produce any new beers for 90 days.
Okay.
So I basically just knew this was going to happen, so I stockpiled beer in the tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And then planned to package down, but then COVID hit. And then
now you have all this product, too. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so then COVID's like this sort of roller coaster of open, not open, open, not open.
Well, yeah. And that's what I was kind of telling you beforehand. It was super interesting because we had the Bayview production facility, which was operational and now full of beer that I was planning to start packaging for the next 90 days so I could have something to sell.
The first facility.
Yeah. And the second facility was not operational.
Okay.
So we hadn't produced any product there. And then COVID hit. And then basically when COVID hit, I realized that there was this massive shortage for hand sanitizer, which is what I was telling you about before.
Oh, yeah.
Before, and I realized that, the biggest, one of the biggest ingredients in hand sanitizer is alcohol, which we all know about now. Mm-hmm. But I basically figured it out, I think, before a lot of people did. Okay. So I started experimenting with it, and it was really, it was more of like a philanthropic effort, I guess. So I was trying to like partner with other people so we can get the product out to like nursing homes and hospitals and stuff like that. So we were experimenting with making hand sanitizer before it became a thing and before the CDC like started allowing distilleries to make hand sanitizer.
Yeah.
So I was already like three steps ahead of everybody else.
Okay.
So I had already been like prototyping it, like figuring out how to make like production hand sanitizer. And then Kaiser approached us.
Okay.
And Kaiser was like, hey, we're looking for like distilleries who are making hand sanitizer. Like, do you think you can make like 10,000 bottles for
wow
San Francisco? And I was like, yeah, no problem. And I think because I reacted so quickly, they escalated it.
Okay.
And they were like, oh, these guys can make 10,000 bottles, so they can probably make more.
Yeah.
So then they took it to Kaiser National.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So then I got the national contract for hand sanitizer for Kaiser.
Wow.
So basically, we had this brand new production facility, this 500-seat restaurant that we just opened 3 months prior.
Yeah.
And I shut the entire thing down and converted it into a hand sanitizer production facility.
Right.
And I was buying literally like container loads of plastic bottles from China, like sight unseen, and like
just get it here. Yeah.
And the supply chain issue just exploded at the same time. So I was just buying whatever I can get.
Yeah.
Just trying to keep up with the demand for the product. But yeah, it was super weird because it's like the first product we made from our brand new, like state of the art facility is freaking hand sanitizer.
Yeah.
Do you think though that either helped or is the reason you survived through that period?
It's the only reason we survived.
Yeah, it was just that.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. So in addition to like, in addition to selling it to Kaiser, we were selling it locally if we had any extra. And then I was basically able to bring like our restaurant workers back in. So like our bartenders and our servers and our runners, and we had them like literally either making it or driving their personal cars around and dropping it off and doing like DoorDash or Uber Eats or whatever. But it was like four hand sanitizer.
Right.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was crazy. So it was like 2 months were like our most successful months in our company's history.
Right. Of hand sanitizer. Yeah. But you know what?
So bizarre.
It's a great so story weird. And it's part of our culture now. Like at least all of us who are alive are going to talk about this forever.
Totally,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? So I would, there's nothing to be, not that you seem like you are, but there's nothing to be ashamed about there. Just not obviously what you planned for your new, beautiful brew house.
Yeah. But it saved us.
Distillery. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a lucky thing for you. You know, mm-hmm. that's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, of course, everything's open. And how's that location doing now, from the, on the public front?
It's good. Yeah. It's okay. Getting there.
It's a restaurant and everything?
Yeah, it's a big restaurant, a cocktail bar. It's got a bottle shop and like beers to go and all that kind of stuff. I was expecting it to be a lot better mm-hmm. because we were so reliant on that tech business that's now just left San Francisco permanently.
Sure.
Yeah, so I mean, the sales are still good. We're like basically now approaching like 2019 levels.
Okay.
But I was expecting them to be like three times as high by this point.
Yeah. So. But those people, I mean, this whole work from home thing is not going to stay like it is now. I do think there's always going to be this like hybrid model, but people are going to return to offices. Tech is going to return. If not tech, something else, green tech, like you name it. I'm not saying it's going to happen in the next year.
Yeah.
But this can't go on, this model that we have right now. The status quo doesn't really work either. You're going to see some sort of hybrid of what you have now, I think. It's my theory. You can't just let entire downtown cities shrivel up and die. Right? It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you're pretty optimistic. I think there's so much technology advance as far as people working from home. Like mm-hmm. I've worked tech jobs remotely and it's pretty awesome. Like,
yeah. It is.
It doesn't even really feel like you're totally remote because everybody you can get to everybody so quickly and so easily.
Yeah. I just think the cracks are starting to show because of the speed of that adoption, because look, it existed before. You had it before,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, Zoom existed well before, But there were reasons we didn't adopt it like so quickly. And I just think that there's a lot of cracks in the fast adoption of it. Mental health, getting out, like, you know, working with others in person. And I just think even productivity will start to, I'm not saying you can't be productive working remotely. You can, but not everybody can. That's just a fact. Not everybody can be their own coach or boss or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. I have stories of running my mouse while I'm doing something altogether different over here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think we'll get a different views on what productivity means and how and what the hours it needs to. So that's why I'm saying there's going to be a hybrid.
Have you ever read The 4-Hour Work Week?
I based my life on it for a while. Yeah.
And you know, like this like idea of working for the sake of working.
Yeah.
I feel like it's just that's one of the cracks that's starting to show. It's that so many people are realizing that you're wasting so much of your time just because you're working for the sake of working. Mm-hmm. So I think that this idea of working remotely is just unveiling that. And it's like, you don't have to sit here and work for 8 hours. Like, you're just doing that because that's the status quo.
Right.
It's like you can get your work done and then go do something else and come back and do some more work.
Absolutely.
Or not, or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's why it's like, to me, it's incredible because I'm now living in San Diego running a brewery and distillery in San Francisco.
Right.
It's just like.
Right.
And everyone's like, how are you doing that? And I'm like, Google meetings.
Yeah, yeah.
I have calls with my team. It's an 8-hour drive. I come up here a couple times a month. Like,
totally.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that even Tim Ferriss, I think, would agree that not everybody takes the initiative or has the ability to take the initiative. Maybe he wouldn't say they don't have the ability. He would say they don't to make that effective. Yeah. Right. So, and there were examples before this, right? So, like, I think this is either in the 4-Hour Work Week or some example from Tim Ferriss. But Best Buy tried this with their offices. Obviously, your retail outlets, everyone's got to show up for work. But on the executive side and the office side, we don't care when you show up for work. You have a cubicle. All we care about is that you get your work done. So go ahead and make your own hours and get your work done.
Yeah.
And after 2 years, they scrapped the entire program because they found that people, many people, are just not good at managing their own time. They never, whether they weren't trained too well enough or it was too abrupt of a change, which is what I'm getting at with what happened with remote work. It was too abrupt of a change to adapt to that new model, right? So that's why all I'm saying is I think you're going to have a partial float back to those offices around your Seven Stills being more full. Not 100% float back, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of my impression of how things are going to go.
Yeah. I mean, Amazon acquired Whole Foods, and now they're rolling out their palm scanning technology in all the stores in San Francisco this year.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. See, that's tech coming back.
But I mean, is there a point of having retail workers at that point?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, why would you have a retail worker if you can have your food delivered by drone and then you can scan your palm at the grocery store?
You're right. The robots.
But there's still like so many people want to live in San Francisco. The rents are going through the roof. Like,
yeah,
I don't. It's so interesting. So what would you do with your 500 seat restaurant? Like if you could
figure
just
out how robots need beer.
Changes, yeah.
Self-quarantine or something. Like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, the actual robot workers. What are they? What products
do
they need?
Robots want. Oh my god.
That's what I think is the real future.
Maybe you could just have like robots who deliver beer and food to people in their homes.
I bet Tim's already doing that. That's what
he probably is.
My feeling, he's not going to tell us, but that's already in his 10-year plan.
Yeah, he's one step ahead.
Yeah, I edit this part out. Yeah. It's in Tim's rider that anything about 10 years down the road, I have to omit from the podcast.
Not me and Elon, don't include it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think there's always going to be a need for restaurants and bars and hospitality because people just naturally are social beings and they're going to continue to want to go out. And like, especially like in a city like San Francisco, like the tech and like the corporate offices are not going to just, they're not just going to go away.
Right.
So they're going to still want to do their corporate parties and their corporate gifting. So it's like, it's always, there's always going to be a need for this, but I think it's just different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I had this discussion with somebody the other day, even with, you know, you also can't go 100% remote. you always need a meeting space in your company. It can't always be on Zoom. How, you know, all hands on training can't always be done remotely. You sometimes have to be together. And this is why I think I have hope for, like, I'm happy that the workforce is evolving. I think that's a necessary, and COVID helped us realize that. But I'm optimistic that it will evolve. It will eventually start to evolve in a way that we can manage, because just flipping it upside down, kind of, I don't know. We are still seeing those pains, but
yeah,
we got to be able to come back from that and be productive again.
Well, it's, you know, like, it's,
and it's got to work for everybody's model.
It's like we had an earthquake and now we keep having aftershocks, and is like causing a lot of creativity to be needed by people who run a small business.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. But how, and yeah, that's going to, this sort of endless, like, as a small business owner, we're on this treadmill, right? Mm-hmm. This constant treadmill right now. Eventually, we got to be able to step off the treadmill and watch the things that we did work. And then we'll get back on the treadmill. That's the nature of being an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
But since, what? I don't even forget now. March 2019, that fucking treadmill won't turn off. And I think that's the sort of evolution we have to see, like, where it sort of goes a little bit backwards as we move forward. I don't know how else to really say it from the workforce perspective. But that's me mostly hoping a bunch of office people are around your new Seven Stills Brewery.
Yeah, I mean, sure. It's either that or you just have to figure out how to adapt.
Yeah.
Which I think is the most important part. And, like, to use your analogy, it might be important to think that maybe you shouldn't be on the treadmill and maybe you should get off and get on a bike. Yeah. Or something.
Like, right. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, maybe you're just going to burn yourself out by staying on the treadmill and you should try something different.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. That's why I'm bringing hard seltzer into my bar.
There you go.
Which we talked about off air, but
yep.
But that's happening.
And that's why, yeah, like, we're making the whole shift to RTD and to canned cocktails, because I think that it's important to stay ahead of the curve. And even though I do think that this, like, this whole ready-to-drink canned cocktail thing could be a fad, I think that if it's applied like craft beer was applied, like, 10 years ago, it could be something that could be staying around for generations.
Yeah. So you guys are about to release canned cocktails from Seven Stills.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
see,
cool.
I'm optimistic about this one, too. I don't think it's a fad. I think it's such a fantastic idea, and that they're so good. I mean, I've had some... At first, I'm like, okay, here we go. It's like truly in a you know, it's going to be something that I don't really enjoy. I'd rather somebody actually make me a cocktail. And you know what? I've been proven wrong time and again on these canned cocktails.
Some of them are great.
Yeah, some of them are very good.
But I think the hardest thing is that there's this giant barrier to entry to start a distillery, which is required to make a canned cocktail.
Yeah.
That the space is being dominated by macro players.
Mm. Okay.
Which I think is going to just stall all creativity, which is why I think that there's a potential that it could be a fad.
Yeah.
But that's also why I'm super optimistic about what we're doing, which is applying the craft to this canned cocktails, which is growing so quickly, so fast.
And you're making the spirit.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. And then what about the other mixes that are going into it? Like, what are you going to make? What's going to be canned?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm trying to keep it super simple.
Okay.
So, like, the whiskey highball is going to be our biggest one, but that's our Chocosmoke whiskey.
Okay.
And it's literally Chocosmoke whiskey and soda water.
Okay.
Wow.
It's a highball. It's super basic. It's 10%, but it's, like...
Nice.
This is meant to showcase the spirits.
Yeah.
And, like, that's how we're trying to apply, like, the craft of what we're doing to this new industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah, we're making craft spirits and we're using those to make our canned cocktails versus being like, yeah, we're buying it because it's convenient, but it's made by Absolut or Grey Goose or
Smirnoff
or Jose Cuervo or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, but that's not the only one you're making, is it? Are you making...
No, so we're making... we're rolling out three right now. So we're... Basically, I'm seeing the RTD, the spirits-based RTD market forking. So it's going in two distinct directions. The first is canned cocktails. So that's the Moscow Mule, it's not called a Moscow Mule. It's called a Vodka Mule.
Okay, yeah.
And then a whiskey highball. And then we'll be adding a margarita on once we get our licenses to start producing tequila in Mexico.
Okay.
And then the other side is the seltzer, but the seltzers are spirits-based seltzers.
I see.
Yeah.
Instead of
ferment.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So things like High Noon. So that's a watermelon vodka seltzer.
Okay.
So it's 5%, 100 calories, no sugar added, like super simple, super easy to drink, but it's made with our vodka.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think that category is. I've had people come in here and say like kombucha is next. I'm like, no, I don't see that. I don't see that happening.
Yeah, well, canned cocktails was the fastest growing category pre COVID, and then COVID just took it into the mainstream.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was sub 1 billion in 2019, and then it's basically grown to 4.5 billion now.
Oh, wow. Wow.
In the U.S.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's huge.
What was the one? It's still out there. It's a huge one that was part of Ballast. Ballast.
Cutwater.
Cutwater. Yeah. And then they made the brilliant decision, I heard at the last minute, to not sell Cutwater along with Ballast, and then later sold that one for another chunk of change. And I'm just like, oh, you boys, you're smart over there. You guys knew what was up.
It's a Budweiser, yeah.
Yeah, what little man from the future, person from the future, I should say, was like whispering in their ear about
they probably had an actual man from the future.
Yeah. I love it.
I can tell you, in my area, the can ban is, well, and they work down here too. Yeah. I mean, they can beer. But they started a whole business based on canning RTDs and canned wine. It's called Tank Space. Okay. So you can bring your beverage there, put it in a tank, and they'll can the hell out of it. And you just go pick it up.
Totally, yeah.
So it's, I mean, they expanded into a whole new facility to do that.
Right.
But that's a really interesting point. So, like, everything that you're seeing on the market right now in terms of the canned cocktail space is either being made by a macro player or it's being made by a co-packer. So I don't want to necessarily say that I have a problem with that. Like, I love the can ban and everything they do, but like all of these people who are making a canned cocktail by using a co-packer are basically charging a premium for their product because they're adding an extra layer onto the system.
Yeah.
So then you're thinking that you're getting a higher quality product like it would be made from a craft distillery because you're paying more for it.
I see.
When it's not necessarily premium quality.
But that's the same problem that every brewery runs into that doesn't have their own canning line, you know?
Yeah, but they don't have anything, right?
What do you mean?
If you make your product with a co-packer, you don't have anything.
Well, you had a fermenter and you put all the stuff together and you trucked it to them and then put it into theirs. Like, they're not, to my knowledge, and I could be wrong, but I believe.
So your product is what you're saying.
Yeah, they're just bringing it there and putting it into their tank so that they can carbonate it and package it.
I see.
So maybe I'm not right about that?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, they produce it all there.
Just, you're talking about specifically with canned cocktails?
Yeah, at Tank Space.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I've been looking into their programs also. Because I don't know, maybe you're right. Maybe they offer that service also.
But. Well, and I mean, for wine, definitely, like, you know, it's winery. Yeah. They're not fermenting the wine. They're not.
So they truck the
packaging.
Wine in.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Exactly.
Huh.
Which, you know, on some scale, brewing has been done too, but not really. But yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And part of their model is like it has to move through quickly.
Yeah.
If it's a problem for them, if you know, you bring your stuff and you don't pick it up right away, like it gets packaged, but they're like the packaging is their deal. So,
but you're saying by that you just prefer doing it all on site.
Yeah, you want to do it all yourself. And
yeah, because I think that we're getting into this category that's either a big player or somebody who's making it at a big player. Not to say Tank Space is a big player, but there's like. The bigger canned cocktail companies aren't actually like a distillery who's making a spirit that they're using to make a cocktail.
Yeah.
They're taking a recipe for a cocktail and they're taking it to whoever's already making White Claw on High Noon and they're having them make it there. And because they're paying this extra step of the process, then they're passing it on to the consumer. And they're thinking like, oh, this is a $17 four pack. It's got to be a craft product. But it's like, it's not. They're just paying.
Not necessarily. Yeah.
I see. Having blurry camera issues at the same time we're blurring the lines of this canned packaging product. I'm being told.
Oh, no. Well, and so, I mean, you're thinking about this in the same way you thought about spirits. It's like, is it really craft because you're making like the thing that just makes the most alcohol and then you're aging it. But yeah, I mean, honestly, your approach makes sense.
Yeah. And we'll make the most money. Let's be honest about that.
Yeah, that's something else I was going to say when you were talking about seltzer earlier. I was like, if you start talking about vodka, that's a different game.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
you know what the cost of a bottle of vodka is?
Yeah.
It's like 50 cents.
Right. I know. The spirits game, which I think is why so many smart brewers, and luckily, in my opinion, brewers who are also interested in distilling, not just like the money. I think brewers learned over the years as they were toiling away for minimal profits, looking at the distilling world going, wait, you made what? You can make what on that?
But I think it's way more competitive.
Okay. Yeah.
Especially in like the vodka game, because they could be like, oh, you have to buy 500 cases of Rain vodka to get your one bottle of Pappy Van Winkle this year.
Yeah. So. Yeah. We've had some of that with beer here on the retail front, like different distributors.
Oh, like holding you over a barrel to get that one special beer.
Like years ago,
it
doesn't have any more. But years ago, it was like if we want a Cantillon, which I always, you know, like. I spent years promoting that brand on this program because I just loved it. And then when I opened a bar, I'm like, cool, we're gonna get that. And whoever the distributor was at the time, not the same distributor, was like, no, that's no problem. We'll get it to you as soon as you buy X amount of McKellar. And I was like, not a real big fan, so I guess I won't serve Cantillon. And that's kind of how it went.
That sucks.
Yeah, I was really upset about it. Not upset enough to change my ethos. I was like, fuck you. I don't do pay to play. Fuck that.
Yeah, that's
not,
cool.
happening.
You're not running my business for me. It's I'm doing this.
Right. Well, I'm not as successful as others either, so maybe my ethos don't always help me. But I was just like, no. That's not something I'm going to do. Yeah.
My idea that was in regards to that was to give bar owners a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle if they bought our vodka.
Right. Yeah.
So like, what do you want? Like, you want the super allocated vodka or super allocated whiskey? Like, here you go.
Yeah.
It's $200.
No problem.
Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, here's your Cantillon. Like.
Yeah. That's what so we got bottles that we couldn't get kegs, but. Yeah, that's just my example. Cantillon is a special place in our heart here. And the other thing I did was, so we did get bottles, that's right. And we're allowed to sell stuff to go. But everybody else around had, since I started drinking Cantillon before I opened this place, had increased their pricing of these bottles by like 1,000%. So before I knew it, you know, I used to pay, you know, $30 for a bottle. And I don't mind paying what stuff's worth, obviously. But by the end, I was paying like $85. So when I opened and I got the case price of it, I was like, whoa, where's this $85 coming from?
$900 case?
Yeah. Which isn't the case. The case price is way cheap. And so retailers, due to the popularity of it at the time, which I will go out on a limb and say I was part of, because we just did talk. We had so many listeners and talking about that all the time. They were just raising the prices because retailers can do whatever the fuck they want. We can price anything we want. So I made a rule. I was like, nope. We put the same margin on all of our Cantillon as we do everything else. There's no separate margin just because a beer is popular. I refuse to do that. But the rule we made was you can't take it to go. Because I didn't want motherfuckers buying it for me for $40 and selling it for $85. Yeah, so I was like, if you want, what I want is for everybody to be able to enjoy great beer.
And you have to give half of it to me.
And that was the other rule. Yeah, the other rule. For every bottle we sell, yeah, absolutely.
I met John Van Roy at Swansea Day.
Oh, nice.
In like 2018. Yeah, it was so crazy. I went over and I introduced myself to him, and he was talking to the mayor of Brussels at the same time. And he's like, have you met the mayor?
That's great.
What is happening right now?
Yeah.
This is so crazy.
He's great. And what he's done is great. And I'm and the American market has helped him stay alive. Totally, you know, I'm glad. But he's not getting the $85 a bottle. He's got his posted price, you know? So anyway.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're short on time.
For sure.
This has been fantastic. We have to have you back because I feel like we didn't even get through all the beers. We've got so much more to talk about. But you can go to 7stills.com. I have that right? Yeah. 7stills.com. You can learn more about the brewery and distillery. You can find out about their locations. Are both locations still open?
They are, yeah.
So you still have Bayview and Mission Bay?
Oh, no. So the Bayview's gone.
Bayview's gone. Okay.
So I lost the Bayview during COVID, but we still have the Mission Bay facility and the Outer Sunset Tap Room.
Okay.
On 43rd and Lawton. But that one is just beer, and it's like a super small, like no frills tap room kind of thing.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. And so we're going to see canned cocktails coming out when?
Next week.
All right. As early as next week.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You must be stressed out right now. You got a lot going on.
Yeah.
What else did Tim Ferriss say to do? Read fiction before you go to bed so you could fall asleep easily. Yeah. You gotta, there's a lot of things he did for people stuff, like yeah. you and me. You got to do.
Yeah.
Sure. well, I wish you luck. The beers are tasting really fantastic.
Thank you.
I now consider you, whether you like it or not, kind of a mentor of mine. I'm going to keep following your career. I think you have a smart view of what's happening, and you've clearly shown that with the growth. And yeah, you took me a little bit by surprise today talking about the four core brands and the six packs. And by surprise, I mean like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. And I don't think I had thought that far about it. So I'm really enjoying learning from you, man.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Sevenstills.com. You can learn everything. All right, Teresa. We done?
I think we're done.
All right. We got a couple shows coming up. What's our next show? Next Wednesday, White Labs, Yeast Company, is coming on the show with us. So we're going to be talking to Chris White, which is always fun, but don't tell Chris this. Honestly, I'm a little more excited that Kara is coming on the show.
Yeah, Kara's the bomb.
She's a badass. And in my opinion, she kind of runs the show around. Like, she knows what's up.
Yep.
So Kara's going to join us from White Labs too, maybe a couple others. So we're going to hang out. We're going to talk yeast. They've got new yeast packaging. I guess it's new like by a year or so now. And discuss all that stuff, all things beer with White Labs. I'm taking them to the baseball game first. So I apologize in advance if we show up slightly less than sober.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's encouraged.
Well, I won't show up a lot less than sober, but I might show up slightly less than sober.
Well, I will do my best to catch up.
Yeah, you might have to come have a couple beers first. All right. Check us out over on Facebook and Instagram and all those things. You can find out about our shows and more. Send your feedback to feedback@thebrewingnetwork.com. Thanks to More Beer once again for sponsoring this program and every program that we do. And we'll see you next time right here on The Session.
The Session is a production of the Brewing Network and brought to you by More Beer. Check them out at morebeer.com. Find more content and live video of this show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/brewingnetwork. For sponsorship opportunities and information, please reach out to advertising@thebrewingnetwork.com. To reach our hosts, contact feedback@thebrewingnetwork.com.